The U.S. men's national team, a massive 4-0 victory in Orlando against Panama, now control their own destiny in CONCACAF qualifying. My name is Carter Krishnayer. His name is Neil Blackman. This is the Yanks Are Coming podcast, post-Panama, pre-Trinidad and Tobago. Another vital game for the United States Tuesday night in Port of Spain. And Neil, you were at Orlando City Stadium. It's great to have the national team here in Florida. Touch a little bit on your thoughts about Bruce Arena's tactics and how he got it right. And then Hernan, who's taken two previous teams to the World Cup, right, in Colombia and Ecuador, was hired by Panama specifically to get them to the World Cup, deciding to go all-out attack in a game where they just needed a point away from home. And Panama now faces, I don't want to call it a desperate situation, but a difficult situation.
Yeah, let's start with Panama even. And well, let's start with this. That was in my eighth year of covering the U.S. national team. That was the best qualifying atmosphere I've ever been in. It was the loudest soccer venue I've ever been a part of. And, I mean, you know, it did the Southern college football culture that surrounds that area and our part of the world quite proud. So well done, Orlando.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've been in the stadium for MLS games and for USL games. You've been in the stadium for NWSL games as well. It gets loud, Neil, but nothing like last night. Nothing like last night.
No, it's wild what happens when you put the American Outlaws on that supporters wall.
Yeah, right, on the wall, right.
In terms of Panama, you know, the press conference with Hernan was Hernan Gomez was extraordinarily contentious, and there was one, you know, about 5-minute, I don't want to say it was 5 minutes, it's probably a 3-minute exchange, but if you think about it, that's a really long reporter and journalist exchange where a reporter said, you know, you named your roster 2.5 weeks early, and this is the plan that you came up with. You know, explain to the people back home why, positively, why this was your plan. And this journalist kept interrupting Gomez in his answer and being like, that's evasive, that's evasive. This is what my, you know, mediocre Spanish is picking up on, but he keeps saying it's evasive. And what was interesting was, so Gomez looks at his press officer for, like, relief, you know, like, tell him, hey, are we going to move on? And the press officer just lets it continue. So that was kind of telling. I mean, I think that Gomez botched it pretty badly. And I asked him, you know, what was with the high line? Because that's not really what they do. And that reporter was right. They had 2 weeks to kind of figure out what to do. I thought his formation with two forwards was bizarre.
Yeah.
I thought using Blas Perez as a starter when he's older and historically has trailed the United States off the bench was bizarre. I thought that, you know, and it was obvious that they got it wrong because they had to make a tactical substitution in the 25th minute, right?
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing about Hernan Dario Gomez is I covered him managing Guatemala against the United States in the Gold Cup in 2007 in Los Angeles. I flew out there for that game. Those were the days when I used to cover the national team the way you do now, follow the national team around. So I flew out to L.A. for that. We had two games in L.A., so I covered both games. One was Guatemala, the second game was against the TNT B team because there was a boycott because Jack Warner hadn't paid the players, if you remember that. And Gomez talked about in the post-game press conference in that game, that's 10 years ago now, granted, and with a far less talented side, the need away from home to absorb pressure. And that's what they did. They absorbed pressure the whole game. And then the U.S. got a goal from, I think it may have been Brian Chin, if I remember correctly. And then then Guatemala started attacking, and Bob had to bring Jay DeMarin on, a fifth defender, to soak up the pressure. But that he talked about spending 60 minutes absorbing pressure to keep Guatemala in the game. His managerial philosophy 10 years later with Panama, and maybe it's because they've had so much success against the United States, and we remember the game in Philly, right? In the Gold Cup, the third-place game where Panama had 15 shots on target or whatever.
Yeah, well, both games that tournament, but yeah, specifically the one in Philadelphia.
Yeah, where Brad Guzan had to make a number of ridiculous saves. Perhaps that lulled him into the sense that he could have at the U.S., and of course, those were Klinsmann's U.S. teams, not Arenas. That being the key difference, tactically.
Yeah, and I think that's the segue, right? Like, I mean, the high line was crazy, and the amount of space that they gave the United States with the high line was even more odd. And Arena, let's back up and say we both agree that Bob Bradley's paw prints are all over this plan, I think.
Yeah.
But the choice to chuck Nagby in, kind of not underneath, but as a shuttler with Pulisic at the top of sort of a modified diamond, and then, you know, that makes sense. But what was brilliant was flooding the midfield with numbers, because they made Panama respect them centrally, which does two things, right? It slows Panama's transitions down because you have to have the right shape to counterattack. And when everybody's helping in the middle in order to counter, it takes longer to get back into your counterattacking shape. And the other thing is, it allowed the U.S. instead to do what Panama wanted to do, which was to pressure and, you know, attack on the break. While Panama tried to probe their way through a crowded midfield. So I thought, I just thought that it was a tactical masterclass from Arena, who has got the tactics right more than he's gotten them wrong, hasn't he, he's taken over again.
No, I think Arena has generally gotten the tactics right in every game. The Gold Cup was B team. It was B team versus B team. I don't really look at that in qualifying. I think every match he's gotten the tactics right. Now, you could argue the Costa Rica game in New Jersey, he got the squad selection wrong. I would also argue you were playing a better team, and when you play a better team, your guys need to have a certain level of intensity, even if they get set up properly. And the U.S. lacked that intensity and made these sort of silly mistakes, defensive errors that you can't coach out of guys, right? You know, you can't set up a squad and a team sheet and account for three or four horrific defensive errors, which is what happened.
Sure, and even in that game, in the U.S., if you, you know, I mean, I know people, this doesn't fit in with the talking points, but the narrative that Arena got the tactics wrong is refuted largely by the metrics, right? I mean, the U.S. chance creation was way better than Costa Rica's.
Yeah.
The U.S. had more shots. They had more possession. I mean, they should have won the game. But, you know, you're right. They made three or four huge defensive errors. Graham Zusi had a bit of a howler. And Tim Howard wasn't very good. And Keylor Navas was. So they lost.
Right. And that's a significant difference. You're talking about, I know we all love Tim Howard, but you're talking about going up against Real Madrid's number one. So, guy who's won the Champions League two straight years. You don't,
exactly.
There's not a more accomplished goalkeeper in the world who's not named Gigi Buffon or Manuel Neuer right now than Keylor Navas.
Right. And, you know, and I thought, yeah, I mean, arguably the worst match for Arena was the Honduras match.
Yeah. That's the questionable one, right?
Yeah, I mean, and they corrected that last night, right? Yeah. I mean, they moved Pulisic back centrally, which I think, I mean, you would agree that any debate about whether or not he should play wide for the United States has to be over now.
Yes.
It's clear his influence centrally is desirable, and as, you know, I know Karnik and I are both people that watched Dortmund play. And, you know, first, just the complementary pieces that they have, the dynamic players they have along with Pulisic at Dortmund.
Yeah, you don't have Götze or Royce or Yarmolenko or Aubameyang on this U.S. team, right? And that's just to name a few. I mean, I can keep going. So I don't know. When you say he plays wide for Dortmund, it's because you've got good when Götze and Royce are healthy, which I know is often not the case.
Correct.
You have those two guys playing centrally, Yarmolenko on the other wing, and Aubameyang up top. That leaves really one place for Christian Pulisic to play. And then he can cut in from the wing. And there are times that you'll see, when you watch Dortmund play, you'll see Yarmolenko and Pulisic switch wings. You'll see times when Götze pushes wide and Pulisic pushes in or Max Philippe pushes wide. It's a much less dynamic set of players. That's not to take shots at our talent level, but it's just the reality, right? We don't have...
Yeah, exactly. And that's the great point that you make, is that, you know, just because he plays there doesn't mean he's not a number 10. And in fact, you know, I think Michael Cox, somebody that we both admire, has identified him as one of the best young number 10s in the world, yeah. Right? It's just that with the club that he's at and that the system that they're in, he's not asked to do that. That's fine.
Right. Dortmund's number 10 currently, when he's fit, is a guy that scored the winning goal in the World Cup final in Brazil. Let's keep that in mind. That's why Pulisic plays wide when Götze is fit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, and not only do they have him, but I mean, we're talking about a club with multiple players who are among, you know, the best young players in the world.
I did this last night. After the game, I actually, out of curiosity, decided I would compare BVB's team to Bayern's. And I think I tweeted it out this morning. We're taping this Saturday morning after the game. I actually think that Dortmund might have a more talented team than Bayern right now. Now, a lot of those guys are under the age of 21, like Pulisic and others. They've sold Dembele now to Barcelona. But they have such a talented, stacked roster. It's difficult to see Pulisic playing consistently as a number 10 there. This having been said, this also is part of the reason why I think he's developed so quickly, his skill set, because he's had to play out of his natural position now under two managers, under Tuchel and under Bosch, the new manager at Dortmund, and he's excelling, and that's he's developing this skill set where he's able to play out wide, cut inside, and use both his feet and his immense dribbling skill to create space. And it's,
yeah, and you saw it on the second U.S. goal last night.
Yeah, on the Altidore goal.
How he can use both feet, and the way that, you know, even when he gets forced out wide, which is actually what happened on that play, he's perfectly comfortable out there, you know, using the left foot, which is on the, you know, the inverted side that he's at Dortmund, and then of course he plays this dynamic curling ball in to Josie. You know, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the thing. Part of the reason I think his ceiling, for example, might be higher than an Mbappe. Not that Mbappe's not better right now, okay? It's just that he is doing that, and it's not two managers, really. It's three, because the role he plays for Arena is so much different.
Yeah, right.
So there's a cross-training element to that, too. He reminds me so much of Coutinho, and I know American fans are going to roll their eyes and be like, Coutinho's not, you know, one of the best players in the world. Well, first, nonsense. Of course he is. but he might be like, there might be more to him than that. He might have a higher ceiling than Coutinho.
Yeah. No, I think he very well might. And I think the thing with Coutinho that we found at Liverpool, maybe not so as much for Brazil. I'll admit I haven't watched him as much for Brazil as I have for Liverpool. He drifts in and out of matches. And sometimes if Coutinho is playing too centrally, he can be marked out of matches. I don't see that with Pulisic.
Right. No, that's exactly. And I think, you know, that's the benefit from being forced to do it for the national team when he's not necessarily required to do it at Dortmund.
Right.
Is that, you know, there's so much meaning in repetition. And, you know, Coutinho is brilliant for the select, but
he's got other guy complementary talents,
yeah,
around,
exactly,
him, whereas
he's
with
also
the U.S.
required to do all the work centrally.
So I've got to ask you now about the U.S. midfield. I think my takeaway from last night And it's been the takeaway from the last few games. I mean, I've been very defensive of Jozy Altidore on Twitter. Maybe it's a South Florida thing, right? I mean, it's a guy that I covered since he was 13 years old watching him. Defending that guy, but I think there were things that he's done off the ball that have kept the United States in games that other guys aren't doing, and I think people finally saw the end product of that yesterday, and then the tandem with Bobby Wood means the United States is going to continue to play with two strikers, I think, because their interplay is so good and their work off the ball is both so good. But the midfield I'm concerned about because I just still feel like in the post Kyle Beckerman post-Jermaine Jones era, and unfortunately there weren't ready-made replacements for either one of those guys. You're having a situation where poor Michael Bradley's having to cover too much ground and do too much work. And I noticed, obviously, in the second half yesterday, Arena made a tactical change. Arena had obviously observed this, too, because the first half, even though it was 3-0, I think he probably was unhappy with the amount of time and space Panamanian attacking players, particularly Quintero and Godoy when he would push forward, were getting on the ball because Nagby and Areola weren't tucking in. I saw that tactical change made in the second half, but is there a case to be made? I think Areola was tremendous yesterday. Is there a case to be made that maybe against better opposition than Panama when you're not at home, because you're not going to have any more competitive matches now at home through this cycle, you have someone other than Nagby who's going to complement Michael Bradley shape-wise a little better in that team?
Yeah, you're right. Arena did mention that he thought that the U.S. gave up too much space in the midfield. Large swaths of the second half. I actually tweeted out a distributional map with a heat map also of Bradley last night. And yeah, I mean, it was a really heavy ask for Michael. Now, he did it. And, you know, Arena was asked by Charles Bohm, who was excellent.
One of the best in the business.
Yeah, was it a gamble to ask that much of Michael? Like, it was obviously a pretty heavy lift in that formation. And Bruce said, yeah, it was. We thought he could do it, and he did. But we also realized about the 50th minute of the game that we needed to give him some help, which had more to do with, he said, we were going to bring in McCarty regardless. It just happened that we brought him in for Pulisic because, you know, we didn't want Christian to continue to get fouled the way he was getting fouled. But, so they did. I think, and this is why this formation, as nice as it looked last night, you know, maybe it's a 3-5-2 in the end, right? Just because I think there's value in getting an Ali Bedoya out there. Just somebody else that will show for the ball.
Oh, well, that's was going to be the next point I was going to make, was that I am still concerned. I mean, I hate to take negatives, or it's not really negative, just talking points out of this game, so that we can evolve the level of play going into the World Cup, going into Russia next year, and a tough game at Trinidad and Tobago where you're going to need to keep the ball in midfield. I still think the only guy in our player pool that I have faith can do that is Alejandro Bedoya, who's been largely forgotten by the supporters base, but hasn't been forgotten by Bruce Arena. And I just have this sense, even though people get frustrated every time he gets selected for the national team, that he's going to be on the plane to Russia for that reason.
Well, Ali's terrific. And I know you and I, you know, we can go ahead and just acknowledge, like, you know, if people think it's biased because we're South Florida,
right. Yeah, again.
That's fine. Yeah, you can think that. Doesn't mean that he's not a really good player. The thing that Ali does, I mean, I've already said, he shows for the ball, he gets open. But the other thing that he does is, you know, Ali's kind of, it's a little bit like Areola in the sense that he's content being a role player. Like, Ali will play a through ball, and instead of charging down to make the secondary run behind it, right, like, he'll peel off and let someone else make that run because he knows that if something goes poorly, you know, you don't want to get caught out on transition. So he's not like a glory seeker, really. And I think that's important if you're going to be the guy that kind of is the intermediary in the midfield between Christian Pulisic and Michael Bradley.
I have to mention this. You know, we get accused of bias, right? But Ali Bedoya is such a legend here in Broward County and Fort Lauderdale, where we both hail from, that the Strikers ownership group, the now failed Strikers ownership group, when they came in, they used as their bona fides to manage a local professional club in this area, the fact that their managing director had somehow had some sort of relationship with Alejandro Bedoya. That was their talking point to create legitimacy. That's how popular that player is in our area. So maybe we are a little biased, but it's for good reason.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think you're right. I don't think that there's not a lot of people in the pool that check that box, which circles us back to Darlington Neck, because it's a point I made in the Yanks for Coming preview that I wrote, and it's a point I only briefly visited last night because I wanted to heap some praise on DeAndre Yedlin, who we'll get to, but it was kind of like, I have only so many paragraphs of points to make, and I thought you and I might talk about it. Nagbe has not, like, I get why he's consistently selected. I get that he is a technically wonderful player in Major League Soccer. I haven't seen anything from him against a quality opponent that says this is a guy you continue to put in the starting 11. I thought he was fine for 20 minutes last night, and then they brought in Armando Cooper, and I thought Nagbe kind of either was a defensive liability because he couldn't handle the physicality of the extra Panamanian midfielder, or that he just kind of gets lost.
Yeah, his touches frustrate me too. I think he makes it. I've noticed this. I remember having the last conversation I had with our dear friend Simon Evans before he moved back to the UK in March was about Nagbe was one of the topics, and I had actually. We were having a discussion about Klinsmann, and of course Simon was more defensive of Klinsmann than I was. But I said one of the areas I defend Klinsmann on was Nagbe. I saw a guy that, to me, was still very raw in his decision making for whatever reason. As talented as he is and as technical as he is, very raw in his decision making on the ball and then his positioning sense off the ball. And that, honestly, Neil, hasn't changed. And I think,
no, he was right. Wasn't he more decisive in the first 20 minutes than you thought last night?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know, he gets it. In fact, in the first 5 minutes of the game, he made a very decisive run and then played a ball out to Areola. And you know, in all frankness, Bobby Wood should have scored.
Yes.
And just pushes it wide. But we didn't. It's like that lasted for 20 minutes. Panama brought on an additional midfielder, and then that was it.
Which is why, again, Ali Bedoya and Fabian Johnson, those two players, Fabian Johnson wasn't on this squad, Bedoya is. Both those guys are going to continue to be, I think, in the mix because Nagbe is limited in what he can do. And that's just, again, some people interpret that as a shot at Major League Soccer and the development system in the U.S. It's not. It's just a reality. He's a limited player. There are some incredible assets he brings to the national team, which is why he's been starting some of these key qualifiers, but there are limitations that when you play different styled opposition on a neutral site in Russia, you're going to need a Johnson or you're going to need a Bedoya or both.
And that's where we should both, because we both have been full of praise for Rita, and I think rightly so, point out that I don't have a problem with Bruce giving Darlington these looks in these big games. You know, because there's nothing that Nagbe does on the field necessarily that I think is like a red flag, get him out of there, right? It's more of, you know, hey, this is a guy that has a lot of technical proficiency, and you can see that there's something there from a quality perspective and a vision perspective that the U.S. has been lacking really since Stu Holden was hurt, but he hasn't shown it against anyone good. And I think Arena keeps playing him precisely because he feels like he has the pieces around him where, you know, that's fine if Nagbe doesn't perform up to optimum expectation. And also because, you know, Nagbe gives great effort, I think. But I think you're right. It's just decisional, right?
Puts a lot on Michael Browning, puts a lot on Villafana or whoever's playing that left back position, whether it's Villafana or Beasley or Fabian Johnson, whoever plays back there, I think has greater responsibility than the right back does. But let's shift to the right back, because I think you saw the difference in this side. Graham Zusi is a gamer. He's a keeper. This is the kind of guy you want on when you're naming a squad for an international tournament where you can't swap players out in the middle of the tournament. Graham Zusi is the kind of guy you take to Russia. Like Ben Olsen was a guy that Arena took in 2006 who could play in multiple places because Zusi has such a diverse skill set. But pace is not one of those things. And you saw the difference with DeAndre Yedlin. I mean, I think there's a probably, I can't remember the specific instance. You probably remember it better. There's a sure shot on target, maybe a goal for Panama, that if it's not Yedlin at right back, if it's one of our other options, I think Howard either has to make a save or Panama equalizes 1-1.
Yeah, Blas Perez.
Yes, exactly.
And he just, I mean, Yedlin ate him alive. And this was, what, 6 days after the play that he made on Salah.
Oh, the play he made on Salah was amazing. And saved a point for Liverpool in that game at St. James Park. I saved a point for Newcastle, excuse me, against Liverpool.
Well, sure. I mean, Rafa Benitez isolated the play after the match and said it's a world-class play. So it's not an American podcaster calling something world-class. So you guys can take all your hot takes out on Rafa.
Yeah, right. I'll put Rafa's opinion up against just about anyone in this sport.
but okay, so let's talk about it. Because there's two things with Yedlin that I think are super important. You've identified pace. That's the first one. The second one is the larger development point that you were making rather forcefully on Twitter yesterday, which is that the U.S. had these 4 years or so of lost development. Yedlin's one of the players from that kind of lost generation. Areola's on the edge of it. And I think Paul, who we can get to, he'll be gone from MLS soon. I think he kind of came back to D.C. to make sure he had reps and visibility.
Before the World Cup. And I should point out, I hate to do this, and we'll get back to Yedlin's play and development under Allardyce and Benitez in a minute, but as I look back, I don't like to give Klinsmann credit for a lot, but I think his stretch, and it was a stretch in 2014 in April when he called DeAndre Yedlin after a good rookie season with Seattle at the age of 19 into the U.S. camp for that friendly against Mexico, and we're thinking, what is he doing? And then he names him to the World Cup squad. I think that was, in hindsight, a brilliant long-term move.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think Yedlin and Wood are his, as a manager, those are his legacies. And then I think a lot of the things he said about technical direction are correct, but that's probably for another podcast. But so this is why you go to Europe, okay? And it's not, Nagby and Yedlin are kind of great contrast in that respect, because DeAndre Yedlin, the MLS player, had electric pace, was service-wise. Now, to be fair to MLS, Yedlin was 21, and players tend to get better.
Not always, though. Not always in MLS. I think there's sometimes a cap.
I know. I'm just saying, just generally, you're right. But you know, oftentimes, weaknesses are shored up, especially if you play for a good manager like a Peter Vermees, or you know what I mean.
Right. And he was playing for Siggy, so I think that's one of the better managers, although people will argue about that now because just the results for the Galaxy in particular since he took over. But I think Siggy, in terms of developing players, I would put his CV up against just about anyone in U.S. soccer other than maybe Bob Bradley and Bruce.
I would too, and that's an interesting point, right? Because when I talked to DeAndre Thursday, you know, I said, what has changed? And his two-word answer was Rafa Benitez. And I said, what do you mean? And he said it's just night and day in terms of my understanding of the game from just a defensive awareness standpoint. He said, I feel like before I was instructed to get in certain positions and I tried to do that. And Rafa's making it more instinctual. Like, and so, you know, there's muscle memory to it. And he said, you know, Rafa will only tolerate, you know, the absolute best in terms of where, you know, what you're expected to do. I mean, you will execute it or you will not play for him. And, you know, it was a really interesting 5 to 10 minute conversation that he and I had. And I thought, you know, you saw it though, but you saw it against Liverpool this weekend and you saw it last night. Edgar Barcenas is one of the better wingers at CONCACAF. They had to remove him from the game. He was rendered entirely ineffective. And, I mean, some of that was tactics and formation, but some of it was they thought that they could exploit. They watched video and thought they could exploit the U.S. flank over there. And, you know, newsflash, Deandre Yedlin is leagues better than Graham Soucy. Although, Soucy, to your point, another point you were making effectively on Twitter yesterday, you were on fire. World Cup squads aren't always built with, like, your greatest players, right? Like, Graham Soucy is 100 times better in a locker room than Timmy Chandler or whatever.
Yeah, this is the point I think so many fans don't understand. They look on paper and say, well, this guy's playing at Borussia Mönchengladbach. I guess I'm saying player specifically. This guy's playing at Eintracht Frankfurt. This guy's playing at Sporting Kansas City, so you pick the guy in the Bundesliga. Yeah, that's what you would do if you're picking a team on paper or a fantasy team. But that's not how it works in international football. For a tournament, you're basically trying to recreate a club atmosphere for 3 or 4 weeks. And again, I mean, we've bashed Klinsmann a lot on this site and on this show in the past, but he took Brad Davis to Germany, to Brazil. I wouldn't have started him against Germany, but he took him to Brazil because he was that kind of guy in the dressing room. He felt, okay, here's a guy who's going to get along with everybody. So maybe I take this guy instead of someone else. Managers make those decisions. Bruce Arena did it with Brian Ching in 2006. He picked Brian Ching over our dear friend Taylor Twellman for that reason, I believe, was that he thought he was just better in the dressing room and Twellman would be a guy who expected to play, right? Whereas Ching was a guy who maybe didn't expect to play and didn't play, but was good in the dressing room as the 23rd guy.
Absolutely. I think Soucy is a future head coach. I think he's a guy that has
his hometown club, Orlando City.
Right. He's got a game-winning assist in a World Cup match. Yeah, there's just infinite value to that. I think one of Graham Soucy or Dax McCarty will make the World Cup team. My guess is it will be Soucy, by the way. Like, I don't know if... And that's why it was cool to see Dax have that moment last night, right, where he gets to play World Cup qualifier
at
his hometown.
At home, right. And I think I think there might have been an evolution in thoughts on Dax because Bob Bradley was assisting, as we've talked about already, with this tactical plan with Arena. And I know from talking to Dax's former coaches, I know, again, Dax is another Florida guy. I know most of the guys he played for in Winter Park and with the Central Florida Craze and PDL, et cetera. And they've told me that they felt like Bradley didn't see the value in Dax when he was a national team coach because he was looking for a guy to flank Michael Bradley, to flank his son, that was able to either win the ball or was a very technical player. So that that left you your options of Rico Clark, Benny Feilhaber, or Maurice Adu.
Right,
Sasha being the technical guy like Feilhaber. So then 8 years later, you have Bradley assisting six, 7 years later with a tactical plan with Bruce Arena. And I saw the kind of Bradley fingerprints on Feilhaber being called in, right? But when it push came to shove, Dax got the call also and got put in this game. So I think maybe there's been an evolution in thought about what Dax now at 30 can do, which wasn't thought about when he was 21, 22, coming out of North Carolina, starting with FC Dallas.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. You know, I think he may end up ultimately lost to the you know, Weston McKennie should the U.S. But all this is contingent on what happens Tuesday.
We should transition to that in a minute, right?
But you know, wrapping up last night, just a marvelous performance, a marvelous atmosphere. really a tactical masterclass. We didn't get into Paul Arriola. We can at another time. I think more than any player last night, he kind of, very briefly, would be the guy to me that gained the most. Like, we kind of knew that Pulisic had that in him. We know who Bobby Wood is now.
We know who Altidore is. Look, right, again, I've been jumping up and down. Maybe it's my bias, but this is not an unexpected performance for me from him.
Yeah, I mean, Yedlin showed how much he's improved, but I don't think his starting position was ever in doubt. Paul Arriola is probably the guy who gained the most just because I can't see removing him from the field when he's fit. he just does too many valuable things that impact winning.
Right, which is why, just to close up, if there's one guy I bump from this squad, not from the squad, but from the first 11, it's probably, again, Nagbe. But that's a conversation for another day. Let's transition to Trinidad and Tobago. They looked very good for 70 minutes with kind of a youngish experimental squad. Last night at Azteca, took a 1-0 lead. There were some handbags and, you know, a little bit of argy-bargy. Mexico then equalizes. They take the lead in, I think, the 88th or 89th minute through Chicharito. Goalkeeper spills the ball, and then at the death get a third goal on a free kick, which was created because Trinidad down 2-1 were trying to counter quickly. So I thought a pretty good performance. I watched most of this game pretty closely. A pretty good performance from Trinidad, but in very classic style of Trinidad or Jamaica, you know, the top Caribbean nations. They can play toe to toe with Mexico, the U.S., Costa Rica for 65 or 70 minutes, maybe even outplay them, and generally fall off. We've seen that through the years with these Caribbean sides. Kevin Molino, by the way, came in around the 55th minute and played well for 20 or 25 minutes in that midfield. You're going down to Port of Spain for this match. It's going to be in a smaller, more intimate venue than we're used to down there.
Right.
Trinidad has a historical grudge against the United States in this sport with final qualifiers of CONCACAF qualifying. We don't need to restate that history. I think everybody knows it who's listening to the show. What can we expect down there?
Well, the Ato Bolden is where the game will be played, Ato Bolden Stadium. And I think just from a pitch perspective, it's probably nicer than Hasley Crawford is. You know, Hasley Crawford is really a track facility where they just happen to play national team matches because of capacity. Whereas Ato Bolden is not a cricket stadium. It's a soccer stadium for their Premier League. So that's a good sign. The one thing I'll say about it is that the floodlights aren't great, so it'll be kind of, it could be kind of dark. Which, you know, whatever, that's part of these games and environments. I'll be interested to see what the crowd is like. Obviously, Trinidad fans knew that they were all but officially eliminated going into Mexico last night. And I'm sure they had dreams of somehow sneaking into a playoff, but they needed a lot of help to accomplish that. And any result by the U.S. would have eliminated them, regardless of what happened.
Right.
My understanding last night was that, as you said, Molino came off the bench. I guess Jovan Jones came off the bench,
and I have to say, did not play well when he came off the bench late.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it looks a little bit like their manager was saving a little something for the return trip, understanding that due to Hurricane Nate, their travel back was going to be a little more complicated, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to fly back, honestly. I mean, I guess they might have to stay in Mexico for an extra day.
Yeah, I saw a tweet by John Arnold, the Goal.com writer who does a great job covering Mexican soccer, who said essentially that they rerouted a lot of their flights. Like, what their federation did was just rebook them. So not everybody's traveling together.
Oh.
And some of them as early as 6 this morning were on planes to various locations in South America where they could then
connect,
slingshot around the storm and go to Trinidad, which is one of these weird places in the Caribbean that is protected from hurricanes just based on geographic.
Yeah, because it's so far south, right? I mean, they never get hit by hurricanes. It's the only place.
Right. They've been hit by one in 100 years.
Right.
So if you're picking a Caribbean island to live in and you're from Florida. But that's interesting. It's interesting that they, like, that the MLS contingent was saved. The U.S. are more familiar with those players. One player that has stood out, at least in the last 6 months, is Levi Garcia, who is kind of an attacking hybrid wing center mid. He can play as an attacking central mid. He can play on either wing. Nice young player.
Yeah, he's a very good young player, and they have a number of these guys in the squad. A guy who played well last night that I want to single out is Kareem Moses, who was playing left back, who's bouncing around NASL for a few years, a player I'm very familiar with. He had a very good game. Was impressed by him, held up with the pressure of Azteca. You know, it's very weird because Mexico beats Honduras, which I expect them to. They're going to have the most points in the history of the hexagonal. And yet there's some sort of lethargy around the Mexican support. And I can't help but think that, and I this isn't a topic for another podcast, I'm sure we're going to get into this, but there's still a xenophobia around enough of their fan base that they won't accept Osorio and his work with their national team in a proper way, because he's a Colombian whose football education is in the United States and in England. And he just doesn't fit the Mexican culture. And I don't get it, but...
Well,
I
you know what, I don't either, yesterday. And smart journalists, you're obviously one of them, but other very bright American soccer journalists agree. I know Charles, who we've already referenced, has said that on multiple occasions. For all the problems Osorio had managing New York, no one ever doubted that he was a good manager. I think that he just tried to do some things.
He was there the year before they moved into Red Bull Arena, and they were building a new stadium. They had gotten to the MLS Cup final the previous year, and there was just, you know, kind of a malaise. Now, he had brought he had brought some players in maybe that were not at the level, and he had tried to get Wilman Conde, if you remember, the Colombian player that he had signed for Chicago before he left from Chicago to New York. There was a lot of bad blood about him. In those days, you didn't have one MLS job and shift to another. I mean, it was a very kind of insular league that way, and every team was attributed to be kind of at the same level. And when you have Osorio make the decision that he's going to jump to New York from Chicago, implying New York is a better job, and he replaced Bruce Arena, who had been fired there, people were furious about it, saying, well, that's not the way our league works. Well, Osorio had been an assistant with the Metro Stars previously under Octavio Zambrano, and then before he had gone to Manchester City, before he got to Liverpool, so where he worked under Julier and then worked under Kevin Keegan at Man City. I think that there was this kind of misinterpretation of that last year in New York. I think he did a fantastic job with Chicago. I don't think anyone will question that. And then did a really good job his first year in New York, and it just kind of fell off. I guess Mexico was just never, and maybe we should appreciate this. Mexico was a country in a footballing sense that perhaps feels like, unlike other Latin American countries, they should be able to hire exclusively domestic managers like Argentina and Brazil do. They don't have to be a country that exports. So many countries in Latin America export either Argentine managers or import, you know, bring in either Argentine managers or Colombian managers. And so many countries in the rest of the world bring in either German managers or Dutch managers, right? It's, you know, this, like, this stereotypical thing. Maybe Mexico has this feeling that, hey, we should never have to bring in a Sven-Göran Eriksson or a La Volpe, or he was Argentine, or a Osorio. They've all got, the three guys I've mentioned have all gotten enormous backlashes from their fan base and have been held to different standard than
Mexican. That's a great point. And I think they've been burned a little bit by them too, right?
Right.
Prior to Osorio, the success of the previous ones was not of the level and expectation. The other thing that it's just fair to say is that, you know, sometimes they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
Putting it bluntly. I mean, because you've isolated it. I mean, they're one victory away from the best performance in a hex ever. A draw actually secures it as well.
Yeah, you're right.
So, you know, they're going to beat the 2006 U.S. mark. And I think what's crazy is that, you know, what they'd rather talk about in the press is that they drew the U.S. at Azteca. And
they're the first Mexican team I can remember to ever get results in a World Cup qualifying cycle, both in the U.S. and in Costa Rica. I don't think in this era that's happened, honestly, as I think offhand. I mean, they never get results in Costa Rica, and they never get results in the U.S., actually. So
no, and they were mad. They're mad about the Confederations Cup. But, you know, the reality is that I mean, Osorio got the tactics wrong against Germany. That happens to a lot of people, though.
It was against Germany. It wasn't against Panama. You know, it was against Germany.
But here's the thing. You're in kind of a double bind if you manage Mexico. Because if you don't go out and try to play the attractive, stylish brand of football that they expect, then they're going to criticize you. Even if you grind out a 0-0 against Germany, right? Look what happened when they tied Brazil at the World Cup and everybody went nuts at how terribly they played.
Yeah. Well, when in fact, I think if it hadn't been for some dodgy officiating in that match, they would have won on Brazilian soil.
Right.
In the World Cup Brazil was hosting.
They would have won that game, and the press reaction at home was, hey, Ochoa was wonderful, but why did we play so negatively? It's like, well, perhaps because you were playing Brazil in Brazil in a World Cup.
Right. Which I think gets back to the point of now the U.S. and the Azteca result. They see this arena U.S. team again counterattacking and playing on the break, and to them, that's anti-football, and they can't get past that. And I at least have to say in their credit, they're consistent. When Mexico does it, they call it out. But I think the Mexican media, there's so many of them, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of two things. One, how football is played in this era where the teams are more athletic and stronger, and when you're facing those teams, sometimes you have to play negatively and look for space and play on the break. And secondly, there's a complete misunderstanding and misinterpretation of their place in the global game.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pulling for Osorio because I feel like this is a Mexico side that has the talent, and the players love it, which also should be emphasized. I think that. You know, I mean, you listen to Chicharito or Layún, or even Diego Reyes
This is the thing. So many of these guys, now Mexico has a problem that maybe we've had in the past. Now we have more and more guys back in MLS. But Mexico has so many guys playing in Europe. They're used to a certain professionalism among their managers and among their management team. Osorio, having spent as much time as he did in England, learning from Gerard Houllier at Liverpool and then Kevin Keegan at Manchester City, all told he spent about 5 years in the Premier League as an assistant, understands how match preparation, how you man-manage, all those things that guys like, I can tell you this from having interacted with Chicharito when I made a trip to Bayer a couple of years ago when he was still there at Bayer Leverkusen. These guys are very European in the way they take care of their bodies, the way they prepare for matches, the way they expect
to train.
And that's something that when you have your classic Mexican league coach, that they don't necessarily have that. Nowadays there are more and more coaches in Liga MX that have come from either Brazil or Argentina or have managed in Europe at some point. So that's changing, but it's the same thing we have with the mentality around MLS coaches and some of the guys who come back from Europe in our pool. So I think it's perfectly understandable, but continue. As you said, the players love
Osorio. They do, and I mean, you know, if you talk to, I mean, Miguel Leon told me that it was, you know, that he basically threw Tuca under the bus, because the other thing about the Mexican players is that they're very candid.
Yeah, well, Tuca's a classic Mexican
when
coach.
When they're doing English interviews.
Obviously, he's a Brazilian, born in Brazil, but he's a classic, you know, Mexican league lifer, basically.
Right. I mean, he said, you know, it's just different. You come into a camp, there's no expectation that you won't play if you're a guy that doesn't play. Right, which was, you know, Tuca had his guys, and every manager does, but the fact that Tuca had, you know, basically would play almost the same 11, and that's the expectation next to him. It's like, oh, well, we know who our best 11 or 12 players are. I don't understand why Osorio's not playing them. And Hernandez says it's incredibly helpful. I mean, they can go and win in Columbus because everybody feels fresh. They don't overtrain. And I'm pulling for them. I feel like this is a Mexico side that can reach a quarterfinal. And then, you know, we all would agree that just from a pure talent standpoint, you know, if they got into a quarterfinal, you know, Uruguay can reach a semifinal, so why can't Mexico? Because there's not a huge distinction.
Costa Rica reached a quarterfinal. They almost reached a semifinal.
Sure. I mean, the United States, you know.
Now, you could argue Costa Rica's top-line talent in 2014 is the best we've seen in CONCACAF in some time, but they didn't have the depth Mexico has currently.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing with Mexico, is that there's so much that is such a deep team. And there's no high-level players like Navas or like Uruguay, obviously. Fortuna, I believe, Suarez, among others. But you know, there's no reason that they couldn't have that breakthrough in Russia.
Yeah, so obviously Trinidad and Tobago Tuesday night, and simultaneously or around the same time, you'll have Panama playing a Costa Rica team that has qualified for the World Cup. Congratulations to them. 4 World Cups in 5 cycles. Amazing for such a small country. If it wasn't for Johnny Bornstein, it would be 5-5. So thank Jonathan Bornstein for that. But that's kicking off simultaneously or almost simultaneously in Mexico, Honduras. We're taping this before Honduras plays Costa Rica.
Yeah, that was going to be my last note, was that game's tonight, Honduras and Costa Rica. And also probably a nurse to Panama's benefit, just because they'll play the Ticos on very short rest.
Yeah, now historically Panama has had this issue of choking on the big stage, going back to the 2005 Gold Cup final. I remember a 2-leg tie against El Salvador where they should have wiped them out and lost to them and were knocked out of qualifying for 2010. And then obviously Panama City against Zusi and Johansson 4 years ago, and then the semifinal in Atlanta of the Gold Cup, which probably was out of their control. They probably should have won that game against Mexico. And now Orlando. They have this pattern of choking on the big stage. My question, and this affects the U.S., to you is, after talking to Hernan Dario Gomez yesterday, as you did in Orlando, do you sense they'll get it back together for Tuesday? Or is it now all just come apart?
Well, I mean, he said all the right things. You know, he said, you know, obviously we get to return home to Panama City. And you know, if we win, we feel confident about our chance in a playoff. We feel confident about our chances of reaching our first World Cup, and that's still the goal. Roman Torres kind of echoed those sentiments.
And they play Australia or Syria. They can't play so open. I hope they learn that if they're in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, certainly against Syria they can't. And then, you know, Australia is kind of weird because they should be better than Syria. They did get the big away goal, but at the same time, you know, they tied Thailand at home in order to actually have to be in that situation.
Right,
so they're not that good, if we're really honest about it.
So other than Aaron Moy in midfield, they don't have the level of player. They've got a generational thing right now like the U.S. also, and their league has gone through some retooling. It's I mean, it just still amazes me if you compare. And this is for another show. We're going to have a bunch of shows between the last qualifier and the World Cup, obviously, to discuss this sort of stuff. But when you compare Australia, the U.S., and Japan's development path, how for some reason Japan seems to have gotten everything right. We've gotten about half of it right, and Australia is beginning to get everything wrong. Right. Even though all three countries arguably started at the same point 20 years
ago.
No,
it's a great point. And, you know, yeah, I mean, they don't have a Pulisic. Yeah. Not many people do.
They don't have a Shinji Kagawa. That's another guy I forgot from Dortmund. You know, Dortmund is just loaded. That's why Pulisic plays out on the wing. But they don't have a Kagawa like Japan
does. Shinji Kagawa is one of my favorite players.
Klopp says he's one of the best players in the world.
He's really wonderful. But yeah, I mean, so this isn't like, this is a playoff they could win. Remember, they were, the one time they didn't really choke was the 2013 Gold Cup final where they played toe-to-toe with the United States. And in the end, it was just Landon Donovan's brilliance that resulted in Breck Shea's moment in the sun.
Yeah, Panama actually played really well in that game. They might have been the better team for much of the night.
Would you ask Breck Shea if that ball was going in?
I always forget that Shea actually scored that goal. You said Landon Donovan's moment of brilliance, and then I'm thinking, yeah, right. And then I forgot somebody actually got a touch on that to take credit for the goal.
It was going in. You know, it's fun to watch it on YouTube, though, and I would encourage people to do that. Is there's one, the actual television feed YouTube clip, when Shea scores, you actually see Donovan go over to give him a hug, and Landon is just laughing.
And Shea's embarrassed by it.
And you stole my goal.
Right, which would mean he would have the record all to himself right now.
But see, that's a great game that's instructive of the Dele Valdez brothers set up to kind of see if they could get that thing to penalty kicks, trusting that after Donovan, the U.S. didn't really have anyone who could finish those. And speaking of penalty kicks, that's the other YouTube video for the next couple of days will be the Altidor Panenka.
Yes. Okay. So last thought on Panama. If Panama doesn't qualify, I think they go back to a native manager like Juan Dele Valdez, you know, like the Dele Valdez brothers, who the great Panamanian players. We saw one of the brothers through an MLS. The other was a star in the J-League. I thought it was a little cruel when they made the change after 2013. And quite frankly, they haven't done any better in qualifying this time than they did that time.
It was a harsh decision, and I think if you were around the Panamanian press last night, that was the sense of dread creeping in that, you know, we hired this guy to get us over the edge, and he just makes this master tactical blunder. And for them, you know, Bruce Arena kind of laughed this off in the press conference Thursday. But, you know, I'll close with this thought. I mean, this is a golden generation for that country.
Yeah, this is their golden generation.
And this is their last chance.
They've never been this competitive before. This is why I genuinely feel bad for them. And people have misinterpreted my tweet saying, oh, do you not want the U.S. to make the World Cup? Of course I want us to make the World Cup. But that I said, hey, I want Panama to make it. And it's because it's a country that has never embraced the sport thoroughly. It's a country where boxing and baseball continue to be more popular than soccer. And they've had this one moment in the sun, this one generation, and a 10-year window to accomplish something, and they keep falling just short. It's not like they're way off the mark. And
exactly.
They have to win this game Tuesday, I think. Otherwise, football in the country might go down the tubes the way it did in Trinidad and Tobago after 1989.
It could, and as I've written on Yanks Are Coming, I mean, they had just this influx of national investment in the last 4 years. Yep. I mean, this is a national pride project.
They have to make a playoff, at the very least. They can't be in a position where Honduras gets in over them. Honduras, who is in a rebuilding phase and is only competitive because they have the brilliant Pinto managing them. I mean, otherwise, I think they'd be last in the hex, honestly. They'd probably be behind Trinidad if they had any other manager. So,
no, I agree. Him and Alberto Lise, who, you know, has Barca, that I saw that there were Barca and Real Madrid scouts at the last Dynamo game.
Yeah,
so that's how good that young man is.
But he's, again, they have they're wholly dependent on either really young players like him or guys like Minor Figueroa and Roger Espinoza, who are past their shelf life.
Yes.
And that's, if Panama doesn't get to fourth over that Honduras team, boy. I worry about football in that country. So,
I'd agree. The silver lining for them is that they traditionally have played well against this Costa Rica generation.
Yes.
You know, obviously they really beat them pretty badly at the Copa America last summer. So, or 2 summers ago now, I guess. But nevertheless, you know, we'll see. It's very, it's certainly possible that they could get this done.
Yep, it's longer odds than they need to be in. And for the U.S.
That's for sure. They made it hard on themselves.
Yes. U.S., just a draw in Trinidad will do the job. We'll be back with you after that game. I don't know when we'll record. You'll be flying back from Port of Spain.
We'll try to do it Wednesday morning for everybody. I'll try to call before my flight.
So for Neil Blackman, I'm Kartik Krishnar. U.S. 4-0 win in Orlando over Panama. They're now in the driver's seat. Just need a result in Port of Spain, assuming Panama gets a result, right? If Panama doesn't get a result, they're in. And
that's it.
We will be back with you next week.